Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Thanks for checking out this podcast from Connecting Faith. You can hear the show live each weekday at noon Central Time, and there are many more podcasts for this and all our Faith Radio shows available online. Our web address is myfaithradio.com. And thanks for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast. Thanks for tuning into Connecting Faith today, and it's really an honor to take some time for the next few minutes to talk to Thomas Cahill, author of a number of best-selling books, and the one that we want to focus on is one that came out here, late 90s perhaps, How the Irish Saved Civilization, the untold story of Ireland's heroic role from the fall of Rome to the rise of medieval Europe. And it turned out to be the first in a series of books that have become the hinges of history books. And Thomas Cahill has written these wonderful accounts, and we're just excited to jump in and find out more. So, Professor, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Neil, for inviting me.
You know, I want to, I guess, if you could maybe set the stage a little bit for us. The fall of Rome seemed to mark the fall of civilization. It didn't seem like the Irish were particularly close to being civilized themselves at that time. I wonder if you could just sort of bring the setting, maybe where the book starts.
They weren't very civilized at all. Some would say that they never got the hang of civilization, but that's another thing altogether. I lived a year, my wife and I lived a year in Ireland, 70, 71, and Ireland was then really still in many respects a third world country and very different from what it is today. You could go to the farthest reaches of Ireland and really find yourself back in a different kind of world altogether from the one that we know. One of the things I discovered there was that there was this great story that almost no one outside of Ireland knew about, which was that there is a huge gap between the classical world and the medieval world. And how did we get from one to the other? Well, the answer is actually, in some bizarrely interesting way, the Irish did it because the Irish had just learned to read and write, and they thought it was great stuff. They were very simple people, but they thought the alphabet was terrific, and they couldn't get enough of it, and they couldn't do enough in the way of copying texts, which was in those days, since there was no such thing as a printing press, copying a book was the only way of getting another copy of it. You couldn't go to a bookstore and buy a bunch of copies or even one copy. You had to go to somebody who had that book and say, could I send a scribe into your library to make a copy of that, please? Would that be all right? You usually paid for things like that. And what really happened at the end of the classical period is that Rome fell under the impetus of the barbarians from the north who could not read and write. And as they went through the Roman Empire, they destroyed one library after another. They looked at these strange compilations, which we call books, and they thought, what are they good for? And they thought, well, the only thing they're good for is to be used as kindling. They knew nothing else. They did notice that many of the more important books, such as Bibles, were encased in jewels. So they very often would pull off the outer part of the book and hold on to that. But the actual text of the book would go up in flames. And as people ran away from them, you have a long period in which the Romans are just running away. By the end of that period, nobody could read and write anymore. The libraries were gone. And if it hadn't been for the fact that the Irish, up in this northwestern corner of Europe, if they hadn't learned to read and write and they hadn't decided to commit themselves to this task, many of them as monks and nuns, and then come back to Europe and reteach Europe how to read and write and how to copy books. If it hadn't been for that, just about all of classical literature would have been lost.
I loved in the way you put it in the book. You described the contrast, you know, the Roman Empire going from peace to chaos, while on the periphery of the empire, Ireland is rushing from chaos to peace. And we have to talk a little bit about Patrick, because he was pretty – it's St. Patrick's Day. We want to just tell us a little bit about what you learned about Patrick.
Well, you know, Ireland did rush from war to peace. The Irish were extremely bellicose people when Patrick found them. And Patrick himself was a Roman citizen of Britain, of the island of Britain, of the province, the Roman province of Britain, as it then was. And he had been stolen as a teenager by an Irish war party, and he was sold into slavery in Ireland, where he worked for a petty king and saw what it was like, what that life was like. Well, people like him, if they got away, never came back. They got as far away from Ireland as they could, and that was the end of that. But he did escape, and he wanted to come back. So he came back as a missionary. He came back as the first missionary to go beyond the Roman Empire. Before that, it's interesting that, you know, even people like Paul, you know, as we read his letters, he's within the orbit of the Roman Empire. He's within the Greco-Roman world. Nobody tried to get beyond that until Patrick. He's the first one to go to out where nobody wanted to go. So he is a man of enormous courage to start with, and what he brings with him is basically the gospel and literacy, because there's no way of implanting Christianity without literacy.
The Irish had, you discussed their sort of core values, hospitality, generosity, and courage. Did that play a part in just sort of the way they approached life and became, in fact, maybe talk a little bit about their role as missionaries, because they went back into the collapsed Roman Empire and planted churches all over, didn't they?
They did. They did. They founded monasteries and churches throughout Western Europe. And those places became, in the 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th centuries, they became the new centers of civilization, because it was a collapsed civilization. And they were the places that had the books, and they were the places that made new books, and they were the places that taught people to read and write and to copy books. So they really were the civilizing centers of Europe in that period, and they went far and wide. They went as far that they would, you know, we have evidence that they got as far as Kiev, for instance. There are examples of their architecture, very simple Romanesque architecture, throughout Europe and as far east, really quite far east. There was a way in which they goaded one another to courage. If you got to France, I'm going to get to northern Italy. If you got to northern Italy, well, I'm going to go beyond that. They were simple, and you mustn't forget that. They were not terribly sophisticated people, and they still held to those simple prehistoric values of courage and generosity. And those were very important to them. And the kind of Christianity that Patrick gave them was, to a large extent, a Christianity that built on their own values, the ones that they already had. It was not a Greek form of Christianity or a Roman form of Christianity. It was a Celtic form of Christianity.
And probably the fact that they were isolated geographically probably kept them from that. So the rationalism of the Roman world, perhaps.
Yes, yes. And they really, you know, and it's very interesting. You see that in these centuries of copying by the Irish, they will copy a Greek text of Plato, but they clearly don't understand it. And the things that you see in great Celtic masterworks like the Book of Kells, which is really a gospel book. Beautiful printing and beautiful little illustrations. You will also in these books sometimes see in the margins comments by the scribes. You know, where they'll say, for instance, "I don't understand this at all." You know, they're doing what they're supposed to do, but they really don't. They just aren't up to Plato. And then also you will see other things. You'll see, for instance, there's a description of the death of Hector on the plain of Troy during the Trojan War, which is the scene that Homer ends the Iliad with. And in the bottom of the page, the scribe has written, "I can't tell you how much this is upsetting me." He takes it very, very seriously. And the way a primitive person will respond to a story, to him it's not just a story.
It's curious, I guess. I mean, I've read different things about these scriptoriums, these wonderful places where, I mean, monasteries many times, and these quiet scribes are just copying. I mean, I just wonder how this country of simple folk, as you say, got so enthused about literacy.
Well, I think they saw it almost as a child's game, what we would think of as a child's game. You know, I learned the alphabet, and by George, I'm going to use it. This is how you do it, see? But they also, the way they used it is interesting. You know, the decorations in the manuscripts, they didn't just write B. They had to say, you know, try it with the bulb of the top bulb of the B going in one direction and the bottom of the bulb going in another direction. They would, you know, they would fool around with the letters, and then they would end up putting little faces in the letters and things like that. Their approach is very childlike. It comes from a childlike culture.
Thomas Cahill is a lifelong scholar and has written wonderful books. In fact, the one that we're talking about became the first in a series called Hinges of History. Six books so far on that. The one we're referencing is How the Irish Saved Civilization, the untold story of Ireland's heroic role from the fall of Rome to the rise of medieval Europe. And we're talking today on Connecting Faith.
April 8, 9, and 10 is our spring share. Hi, I'm Dick Whitworth, General Manager of Faith Radio. Together with friends like you, we can bring God's love to the Upper Midwest every day through relevant Bible preaching and family-focused teaching. If you're not already a member of our monthly support team, would you consider joining us during spring share? A special gift or an ongoing monthly pledge would make such a difference. Join us April 8, 9, and 10 for spring share.
There's no shortage of messages in your life. Phone calls, text messages, face-to-face requests.
Mom.
But in the midst of your daily communication overload, find messages that build your faith and encourage your walk with God. Compelling stories, insightful podcasts, and ways to get involved. Get the latest from Faith Radio in your Facebook newsfeed when you join us on our Facebook page. Just search My Faith Radio on Facebook.com to join us today.
Joined today by Thomas Cahill as we talk about his best-selling book, How the Irish Saved Civilization. And you were talking about the childlike approach of the Irish as they were working in their scriptorium and just copying all these books. I sensed a little bit later on in the book, you talked, there was kind of a playfulness, it seemed like, a willingness to not take oneself too seriously as these monks sort of moved out into Europe and sort of ran into the Roman church in many ways.
Yeah. They lack the dignity of the Romans, you know. It's just not their thing. They prefer jokes and humility, I think, in many ways, to the dressing up of the Romans and the more serious meetings that occur on the continent between, say, two bishops. They're just not quite up to that sort of thing. And humor is never terribly far beyond them. And that humor, I think, does unsettle the more august churchmen of the continent. But they need the Irish at that point. You know, they really can't manage without them. So everybody somehow manages to keep himself from condemning the other. So this is, of course, long before the great rendings of Christianity. And it is amazing how people very, very different from one another manage to coalesce for the sake of, well, really for the sake of the evangelization, of a real evangelization of the continent.
So are there some aspects of the Irish perspective of Christianity that, you know, that still had influence in the midst of this, dark ages that, you know, where maybe the Roman Church sort of reasserted itself later on? But are there elements of the Irish influence in the faith today?
Well, I think that some of that has been rediscovered. You do find people talking about Celtic spirituality, and a lot of that has to do with love of the earth, love of nature, including the natural world in one's spirituality. So I think there is a rediscovery. There has been a rediscovery, especially, I think, of the prayers of these early monks and nuns. Some of them St. Bridget, actually, there's a poem by St. Bridget that begins, "I would like a great lake of the finest ale for the King of Kings." She's talking about Jesus. It's very sweet and lovable. And that is an example also, I think, of how close the Irish were, how far they were from difficult thoughts and how close they were to the earth and to simple things like food and drink.
In fact, you mentioned St. Bridget. There was it seemed like women played kind of an interesting role in the growth of Christianity, at least in Ireland. I mean, they were probably innovative before their time in some ways, weren't they?
Yeah, well, the other thing is, I think that, you know, if you read the most ancient texts that the Irish left behind them, though they couldn't read and write, they did have a great oral tradition. And there was an epic, an Irish epic called the Toine. It's spelled T-A-I-N, but it's pronounced Toine, and which means cattle raid in Irish. And it was about a great cattle raid that went from one end of Ireland to the other. And the main character is a woman, a queen named Maeve. And it looks, from reading that and a few other things that we have left, that women rated much more highly in Ireland than they did in the Greco-Roman world. They had real power. So that in Irish Christianity, there are really important women, and they're not just also rans in any way at all. You know, in many ways, Bridget, who is probably a convert of Patrick, in many ways, she looms larger in Irish imagination than does Patrick. There are many prayers by her that are remembered, and there's a lovely church that she was founder of, and that people still make pilgrimage to. And I would say that it's an extraordinary exception to the early Christian world, where men are simply in charge everywhere.
We're talking today with Thomas Cahill, best-selling author of a number of books, including How the Irish Saved Civilization. And it was the first in a series called Hinges of History. And the latest that just came out a few months ago, Heretics and Heroes, How Renaissance Artists and Reformation Priests Created Our World. And you talked a little bit about, just to reference the sort of rending of the church that came, we think about, I guess, the Reformers. But maybe just sort of jump ahead from the influence of the Irish. Was there a time where, I guess, what Rome sort of reasserted itself in the church? I guess it seemed to me, as I was looking through the book, that there was an awful lot of emphasis on rooting out heresy, or so-called heresy.
Well, you know, given its title, yeah. We could hardly do anything else. But that is the sixth book in the series. The How the Irish is the First. And my and How the Irish is an introduction to what I think is a new way of looking at history. Instead of looking at all the horrible things that have happened, what I try to do in each book, and the second book goes back to the very beginning of the Western world, it's called The Gifts of the Jews, and it really is an introduction to what Christians call the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible. And then I come forward, and now I've got, in the sixth book, I've got as far as the Renaissance and the Reformation. But what I'm trying to do in each book is to answer the question, what happened in this era that is still of use to us, is still important? What value emerged in this era that we still need, that we still depend upon? So it really is a kind of look at the evolution of the sensibility of the Western world in its most positive aspects. And Heretics and Heroes, well, I called it that. Actually, I started by calling it Heroes and Heretics, but my publisher convinced me that heretics is a much more interesting word than heroes, so I should change it around to Heretics and Heroes. But in this book, most of the heretics are heroes, and most of the heroes are heretics. So it depends on how you look at them and what, you know, what your stance is. What really happens in this period, before the Reformation even, but in the period of the very earliest part of the Renaissance, which is not only Italian in origin, it's really Florentian in origin. It really starts in the city of Florence. What you have is a new sense of individuality, a new sense of the self, whereas in the medieval period, there's very little in the way of I. I want this, I did that. In this period, both in its Renaissance aspect and in its Reformation aspect, you have for the first time people really promoting the I, the inner self. What Luther stands before the Holy Roman Emperor and his court and says, I cannot go along with this because my conscience won't allow it. The I becomes his I goes into the forefront of what he has to say. And it is a new development for the Western world. It really is the development of what philosophers would call subjectivity. The self, who I am and why that's important. Well, it wasn't terribly important to the people Luther was speaking to. The emperor and his court had probably never heard such a speech as that before. But it was important to Luther, and it became important to his followers, and it became important to the subsequent reformers. It finally became important to everyone. There's no way around subjectivity in our world. As I say in the book, these are the first people who would have understood a magazine named People. You wouldn't have had that in the Middle Ages, and you would never have anything remotely like that in the ancient world. It is the first time that that you get this sense of the self, of people saying, I, and however silly People magazine may be, it's a kind of silly example of that, and it's very important to us, and it really, in someone like quite before the actual Reformation, in someone like Michelangelo, you have the same thing. You have a man who is obsessed with his own vocation. How is he going to do this? How is he going to express what's inside him? And what comes out are these incredible statues, such as no one had ever seen before. And finally, paintings, which he never wanted to do. He ended up working for the Pope. That's why he did the Sistine Chapel ceiling, because the Pope wanted to decorate that ceiling. Michelangelo didn't think it was terribly important. He thought that sculpture was much more important. He thought that he looked down on painting, but he did it because the Pope asked him to do it, and he needed a job.
It's a fascinating coverage. The book Heretics and Heroes: How Renaissance Artists and Reformation Priests Created Our World, and you will find it in the series of six in the series The Hinges of History, from scholar and author Thomas Cahill. And it's an honor to talk with you, and wish you great research and writing in the days to come.
I was very happy to talk to you. Thanks for the opportunity, Neil.
Thomas Cahill, we talked about how the Irish saved civilization, and on the way to Heretics and Heroes, that the latest from Thomas Cahill, joining us today on Connecting Faith. You're listening to Connecting Faith, and coming up here in the next half hour, we'll shift gears away from talking about the Irish during the fall of the Roman Empire and time of the Renaissance and the Reformation to the church in the modern era, and for that, we'll get some perspective from Leith Anderson. We're grateful to have the opportunity to spend some time talking with Leith Anderson today. Leith is the president of the National Association of Evangelicals. He served as senior pastor at Wooddale Church for 35 years and has been a leading spokesperson in what's happening in the church today for many years, written 10 or more books, and we're happy to just spend a little time with him today to talk about the church. Leith, welcome. Good to see you.
Thank you, Neil. Great to be with you again.
Maybe just in terms of looking back from the your position, I guess, as president of the NAE, which is an organization with thousands of churches represented, what's your assessment of evangelicals in America?
This is a good day for evangelicals. Evangelicals represent a significant, perhaps the most significant segment of Christian faith in America. And America, unlike many of the Western industrialized countries, is a country where faith and religion are part of front page news stories and conversation every day. So evangelicals in the early part of the last century were facing some formidable challenges and finished the last century very well and began this century strong.
There's just a report out about the growth of megachurches, over 1,600 megachurches in the country, over 5 million attending each weekend for worship. And yet, I guess we know that the majority are in churches with 100 or less. So is there a kind of a growing disparity there?
Yeah, well, if we want to get into statistics, actually, I think that you could say the majority of churches are 100 or less, but not the majority of people. Probably the majority of people are in the top 14% of churches in the United States today. There are about 400,000 churches in the country, give or take. And the median-sized church is 75 at worship on Sunday morning. I sometimes tell pastors, if you're in a church of 76, you are in one of the largest churches in America. And, you know, statistically, that is actually true. But if you can take a little more statistics, sometimes people will say, well, I'm in a smaller church. And I say, well, what size is your church? And they say, well, we have about 250 on Sunday morning. And I remind them that that is the 95th percentile. A church of 250 is in the top 5% of all churches in the United States. So most churches are not large in attendance. And while megachurches get a lot of visibility, and rightly so, they have a lot of influence, that's not the whole picture. Different people are in different contexts.
But do they drive what happens in some of these major churches? Do they drive a lot of what's changing or maybe new trends in Christianity in America?
Well, they often have the resources to be able to experiment in ways that others can't experiment. And experiments, when you don't have a lot of resources, can take you down. If you have larger resources, then you can probably survive if it wasn't the wisest choice of all. But, you know, there are people who like small churches. There are many places where small churches are appropriate. It is true that churches of less than 500 are facing some stronger challenges than in the past, and churches that average over 500 tend to do better right now. But, you know, we can't have the whole picture based upon just a statistic. Most of us, you know, we're familiar with our own church and our own context and our own community, and that's where we're spiritually fed, and that's what we want.
Maybe it brings up the question, I guess, about measurement. Is size the only thing that really matters when we're measuring the strength of a church.
Oh, no. There are wonderful churches that have smaller numbers, and there are some churches that have some serious problems that have larger numbers. So just as you can't say that somebody is healthy because they're 7 feet tall or they're not healthy because they're 5 feet tall, that's just sheer silliness. And church health is really much more important than the statistics.
We'll talk a little bit about mega churches. I know it's one of the things that seems to be happening more is the multi-site church. And I know you pastored a church for many years that planted churches. What are you saying maybe in terms of planting churches versus maybe multi-site? Are things changing in that respect?
There are more multi-site churches. I don't know exactly what's going to happen with that. My best guess is that if you give a generation, they will become separate entities. We have thousands of years of precedent in that. And this has been a generation of astonishing church planting in America. I mean, I think back, because I'm old enough to think back 30 years, and denominations weren't starting new churches. And I can just tell you that the denominations and groups that are going to be strong 25 years from now are the ones that are starting new churches today. And the great churches in America 25 years from now are churches you've never heard of because they haven't started yet. And as someone who travels a lot across this country and enjoys getting off the interstate with a rental car and going into small communities, I can tell you that virtually every school, every theater has a new church. So new churches are just cropping up everywhere. It's amazing. And they're almost all evangelical churches.
Which I guess you mentioned denominations. I mean, we've seen that trend for some time that maybe denominational connection not as important. Mainline church has been sort of decreasing. What do you see there?
Well, mainline churches have been declining in numbers, not necessarily in number of congregations, although that's probably coming with some aging of constituency, whereas evangelicals have done very well and have been growing. And probably 80% of the mega churches in America belong to a denomination. You may not know it. So you may not know that Saddleback is a Southern Baptist church, but in fact it is. And you may not know that Redeemer Church in Manhattan is a Presbyterian Church of America church, but it is. And so it is across the nation that many of the churches that are significant and influential are denominational churches.
Let's talk a little bit about maybe just in general challenges for the church in a secular society today. Is it greater than it was a generation ago? I mean, you pastored for one church for 35 years, so you've seen a lot of change and growth, but how would you assess where we are today, maybe in some of those cultural challenges?
We certainly have cultural challenges, and we certainly have political challenges. One of the roles of the National Association of Evangelicals is that our headquarters are in Washington, D.C., and that's where my office is, and we're engaged significantly in court cases, in involvement with the administration and the Congress. So, yeah, those things have high visibility. But the church has always struggled with cultural challenges. Sometimes people will tell me, we live in an extremely difficult age. And I say, well, that's true. And I say to them, do you realize that heroin and syringes were sold in the Sears Roebuck catalog and delivered through the United States Postal Service in 1900, that predates the prescription laws that we have today? So some of the challenges that we have with drugs are not as great as they were. Or that the per capita consumption of alcohol in America is dramatically less now than it was before the prohibition. And that's not to underestimate the problem with drunk driving and alcoholism, but it is to say that we need to be aware of what has happened over the longer course of time, and we are not the only generation of history. We can learn a lot from what has happened in the past. Yeah, you know, I watched a two-segment show on the History Channel on Pompeii, and I've actually visited Pompeii a couple of times. And the gross immorality, the astonishing sexual misbehavior in Pompeii, which is all documented because it was destroyed by the eruption of Mount Vesuvius. And while I grieve immorality in America and some of the things that we are facing, I compare it to what they describe in Pompeii, and we don't have the problems they had. And yet the church flourished in the time of Pompeii in the first and second and third centuries because they were central to the gospel of Jesus Christ. And as we are centered on the gospel of Jesus Christ, that is far more important than the cultural challenges.
You know, just to follow up on that, are you seeing evidence of flourishing where churches are sort of most true to the core elements of the gospel. Is that the what really seems to be attractive today? I mean, we hear a lot about, you know, it's social engagement, those things. But what are you seeing that's attractive in the church today?
Well, recently Pope Francis was talking about many of the social issues, and he had an interesting statement. I wish I could quote him verbatim, but he was saying essentially that many of the issues that the Catholic Church has confronted, which I think they have rightfully confronted in the broader culture, are really important. But what is most important is the gospel of Jesus Christ. And he absolutely got that right. What is most important is the gospel of Jesus Christ. So churches that center on the gospel rather than on many of these other issues or their own internal identity are the ones that are on the right track. But, you know, let me also say that God is astonishing in the way he chooses for his Holy Spirit to bless churches and Christians. So I see examples of those that do things that, in my estimation, are crazy wrong. And God, in his grace and sovereignty, says, this is a vehicle that I'm going to use. And we see that in the New Testament. There were people that did strange stuff, and God blessed and strengthened the church anyway. And that's our hope and our encouragement, that this is about Jesus Christ. It's really not about our denomination or size of church or pastoral style or all the things that we count often to be far more important than maybe they really are.
Remember one of your, one of your first books talking about churches and change, and something about, you know, many church leaders would like to wake up and believe it was 1950 again. Do you think that's still the case today, or have we moved into the 21st century, most of the church?
Well, churches are slow to change, and actually that's probably a good thing, because they're maybe less likely to run with fads, and we are all tempted to do that. There's such diversity. There are actually some people who, in the name of being contemporary, are doing things that were done in 1950. They just weren't around in 1950 to know that what they are doing is actually going back in time in the way they do it. And it's fine. What needs to happen in every church is we need to understand what is the culture of that community, and then how do we communicate Jesus Christ in that particular culture. Well, one of the comparisons I sometimes make with people is when someone is a Muslim, their holy book is the Quran. And if you are a really devout Muslim, then you learn Arabic because that's the true Quran, not a translation. Christianity is quite the opposite. The Bible was written in Hebrew and Aramaic and Greek. What we do is not focus on having everybody go and learn that language. We take the original languages and translate it into the language of the people. And that's what we need to be doing, is saying what is happening in our world, our country, our culture. We need to understand that. We need to read that. But then we need to continually translate the message of the Bible into what is the contemporary culture so that people understand it. And that needs to be in the life of the church, but also in our individual Christian lives.
I've noticed it seems like there's a greater emphasis or discussion than in terms of language. We talk about being followers of Jesus, that it's not so much about it's not born again anymore. We maybe don't even use the word Christian so much. It's followers. Is that kind of language making a difference or helping us refocus on the central point of the gospel?
Well, I think it's helpful with some people, but it's different with others. So some people will be referring to being disciples or followers of Jesus or Christ followers or being saved. There's lots of different terms, and most of those are biblical terms, so they're okay terms, as long as we're not compromising the central message and the truth of the gospel of Jesus Christ. If we are doing it because we are embarrassed to be Christians or we don't like what the gospel has to say, I say that's wrong.
Leith Anderson is president of the National Association of Evangelicals, a longtime pastor, author, and speaker in our studios today as we talk about the church in 2014. There's more to come on Connecting Faith.
On Tuesday's Faith Radio Mornings, we'll hear some more great advice for our finances and investing with Dave Sapransky. We'll also get an update on his recent missions trip to the Amazon.
And at 7:40, do you ever have doubts about the biblical account of Christ's resurrection? We'll be joined by author Brad Watson as he actually encourages us to doubt in order to believe. His book is Raised, Finding Jesus by Doubting the Resurrection.
We'll update all the latest in news, too, with Don Rupp. Join us for Faith Radio Mornings starting at 6 a.m.
Hi, I'm Dick Whitworth, General Manager of Faith Radio. Are you new to the station? Well, welcome. It's great to have you tuning in. We have a new listener packet that's designed for friends just like you. It tells you a little bit about the station, who we are, why we exist, and what we're hoping to accomplish in the Upper Midwest. It's yours free for the asking at myfaithradio.com. Check it out. It's myfaithradio.com. It's the new listener packet. Request yours today.
Leith Anderson is our guest. He's president of the National Association of Evangelicals and has served as a senior pastor of Wooddale Church for 35 years and has written a number of books, and we're happy to have him in studio today as we talk a little about the church looking back and looking ahead. Leith, you mentioned that as NAE president, you have your offices in Washington, D.C., and so there's opportunities to interact with leadership and government. Give us a little sense of maybe what some of the challenges are there. We've heard talk about there's this sort of emphasis on freedom of worship versus freedom of religion, that is public expression of religion becoming marginalized. Where do you see the issues there?
There are some risks that we are now facing. We do need to understand that if you travel to other Western countries, if you go to Australia or Canada or UK or Europe, you will find that Christian faith in particular, but religion in general, is not much in the public conversation, nothing like it is in the United States. And when you pick up newspapers or watch television, it is astonishing how frequently matters of faith, and particularly Christian faith, are woven into our society. So that is really good. On the other hand, there are some sad challenges. A good example of this currently is the government's what's called the HHS, Health and Human Services, mandate on contraception, that it be included in all health insurance policies. And there are different views on contraception, and Protestants and Catholics have a different belief concerning that. But to say that the government can impose a regulation that controls your religious belief behavior and you're fined if you don't cooperate with that, that's putting religious liberty at risk. And I'm grateful for the Green family and Hobby Lobby and Conestoga Woods in Pennsylvania. Their case has been accepted by the United States Supreme Court. And I certainly hope that the Supreme Court rules that the most important issue here is our religious freedom issue, not some government mandate.
We hear a great deal about persecution, religious persecution around the world. Are those issues that come up in the offices of NAE in terms of what's happening in our country? Or is persecution not, it doesn't really qualify at that level? Or?
We don't have persecution the way Christians are persecuted in the Middle East, and that is a center of persecution right now, because we have had these dictators in the Middle East, and they have done some atrocities, but many of them have actually protected religious minorities, including Christians. And with the Arab Spring and some other things that have happened, it has actually significantly increased persecution of churches and believers. And that really breaks my heart, because we're talking about places where the Christian community goes back 2,000 years, and countries like Iraq have hundreds of thousands fewer Christians now than they did 20 years ago.
Is there a place, a role that, you know, is your leadership at NAE? I mean, are there ways that we can bring some effort, some attention to bear to this issue and make a difference?
Well, for example, at the end of 2013, the NAE and others had a day of prayer for those in Syria. 100,000 people have died in Syria, and Christians have been deeply hurt. Many have died. So I would put prayer at the top of the list. In terms of the political side, I would keep prayer at the top of the list on the political side as well. But we need to continually encourage our government to be seeking protection for those who are persecuted, and those are minorities. And it's not just Christians. It's other religions as well, that they not have to suffer because of that. And for example, I was a year ago in Geneva as part of a U.S. delegation, the United Nations High Commission on Refugees, and that the U.N. protect people's religious beliefs in refugee camps. And we met with ambassadors from around the world. It's those types of things that we need to be advocating for and praying for, because it's a tough day for a lot of believers in Jesus Christ.
You know, you mentioned here in America, U.S., it seems like there is religion is still part of the conversation, although maybe not as much as it used to be. But there is a recent Gallup poll, the Honesty and Ethics poll, and the clergy dropped a few points. I wonder if we just are we sort of looking for bad news? And maybe what's your sense of the general public perception of clergy and media in general? Do they look at a church and say this is a value to the community, or has that changed?
There are certainly clergy that are ethical and unethical. I think the probably good news is clergy are getting a higher rating than the Congress is currently been getting. But, there's a lot of ratings that are higher than the Congress. I'm always saddened by ethical breaches and misbehavior among those who are pastors. I don't think it's particularly different than it has ever been. And I don't think it's particularly different from other professions. What we need to do is continually be called back to a high biblical standard, and we need to be honest, we need to be moral, we need to be ethical, and the church has a responsibility to give supervision to clergy to make sure that that happens, and there should be discipline when it doesn't happen. However, I remember one time I had, I think it was Fox News cameras in front of me, and they were asking me about the moral failure of a well-known pastor. And I said to them, there are about 450,000 pastors in the United States, and one of them has misbehaved. So let's talk about the other 499,999. And after we've talked about them, I'd be glad to talk to you about this particular person and what happened. It's just not fair to blame everybody for the misbehavior of a few.
It does seem like there's always issues about doctrinal purity and some of those things. I don't know if NAE, gets involved in those kinds of, discussions. But, the church has, over the course of its life, has always sort of wrestled with, what is it that we believe? What do we hold dear? Do you see some of those issues on the forefront or not so much?
I don't know that I'm seeing any fresh wave of doctrinal controversy within the churches of the United States. Evangelical churches certainly have differences in beliefs about mode of baptism, or they're Arminian or Calvinist. But when it comes down to the central gospel of Jesus Christ, when it comes down to, I do a monthly survey of evangelical leaders, and a year or two ago I asked the question, is there any other way to salvation other than through Jesus Christ? I think it is the only time we have had 100%, every single person that was surveyed said that Jesus Christ is the only way of salvation to salvation. So yes, there are always going to be a variety of differences. There were in the New Testament. There's nothing new to that. But when it comes down to core beliefs in the authority and trustworthiness of the Bible, in the doctrine of the Trinity, in Jesus Christ being the Son of God, our Savior, that He rose again from the dead, that He is the way of salvation, there is unanimity.
One of the areas that we've heard a lot about is the relationship between millennials and the church. Barna and many others have done studies. They're leaving the church. But I don't know, what are you finding? What's your sense of maybe just what millennials' influence and impact in the church will be in the years to come?
When I talk to pastors, and I'm more likely now to talk to denominational leaders and people that are seeing the broad picture, they are extremely encouraged about millennials and young adults in general. There are surveys that, and anecdotal stories, some of them hypothetical, that talk about those young adults leaving the church. I think that that is not, in fact, true, nor is it the reality. Probably the gold standard for research in the United States is the General Social Survey. It's a secular survey. It's much more thorough than any of these others that you have mentioned. And it actually, and it is very broad, and it actually shows an increase in church engagement, not significant, but an increase among millennials and young adults. So the trend, while slight, is for greater engagement of younger people, not lesser engagement.
And is that engagement at a different levels, or is there different maybe motivations or styles or approaches? I mean, you mentioned earlier that the churches 25 years from now won't be anything like maybe the ones we have today. So.
Well, there are generational characteristics, and that has always been the case. And my education is in sociology, so I have a tendency to look at that. However, there also are changes within generations. I remember talking to one of our sons when he was a teenager, and he said, Dad, in the future, there aren't going to be any early church services. They're not going to be at 8:30, 9:30 in the morning. He said, they'll all be gone when my generation takes over. And I said to him, you know, let me just say that when you are married and have children and they come and bounce on your bed at 5:30 in the morning, you are going to be anxious to get up and go to an early service with an early Sunday school. He didn't see it that way then, but you see it differently at a different time in life. And so some of it is generational characteristics that continue through the generation, and others of them change as we go along. Let me mention one other aspect of significant change that somewhat relates to this, and that is the astonishing positive impact of immigrants to the evangelical churches of America. And when I talk to denominational leaders, I often ask the question, is your denomination growing? Are your churches growing? And with very few exceptions, the answer is always yes, sometimes stunningly growing. And then I say to them, all right, tell me about the growth that is among immigrants and the growth that is among native-born Americans. And usually the answer tilts toward not much, if any, growth among native-born Caucasian, suburban-type people. But among immigrants, it's huge. So the growing edge of evangelicalism in America is clearly immigrants that have come to this country. And we are in a period where there's been significant immigration, and much of our immigration has come from Christian countries or countries where the gospel is advancing rapidly, just huge revivals that are taking place. So much of that spiritual vigor and renewal is coming from Latin American countries and China and other places around the world. And I think 100 years from now, historians are going to look back and they're going to say the beginning of the 21st century, the great blessing that God gave to the evangelical churches of America was our immigrants.
Amazing. Well, Letha, we'll wrap up our time and just give you an opportunity maybe to say, you know, what you're maybe most excited about or optimistic about. I mean, God is still at work. What's, as you look ahead, what encourages you the most?
I am just overwhelmed and delighted with what God is doing around the world. And while the National Association of Evangelicals focuses primarily on America, the reality is that we live at a time unlike any other time in history before. I sometimes tell people that you've heard pastors say, when I get to heaven, I'm going to go and talk to Peter and Paul and Andrew and James and say, what was it like? I'm going to get in line and ask them, what was it like in the first century when God was doing his great thing? I think it may be the other way around. I think that Peter and James and Paul and all of those may be lining up to talk to you and me, saying, what was it like at the beginning of the 21st century when God did his greatest thing for the Church of Jesus Christ around the globe? And then they're going to say, and what was your part? What was your part in this great day for the church and for the gospel? And I hope we have a good answer, that we recognize what the Holy Spirit was doing and that we shared in this great blessing of God.
And maybe that's the challenge, right, that all of us, we all have a part to play. Right?
We do. And our part is not primarily to find out what's wrong. It's primarily to see where God is blessing.
And get in step with him there. Leith Anderson, president of the National Association of Evangelicals, giving us an update today. Leith, blessings to you. Thanks so much for what you're doing and for sharing with us today.
Thank you, Neil.
And thank you for joining us today on Connecting Faith. If you missed part of the program or want to share with a friend, you can do so by going to our podcast archives online at myfaithradio.com. Click on Connecting Faith.